This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 19th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 58th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This show is dedicated to photographs, to the stolen image, the posed picture, the art and craft of framing a perfect shot, of curating a show of them, of selling them, of commissioning them, and discussing their artistic merit. The photograph as reportage then, the photograph as art, the photograph's troublesome relationship with the truth, and more. I hop the Eurostar to visit Paris Photo, the largest and best photocentric art fair in the world.
You have the feeling that you're not at a fair. You have the feeling that you are treated, you know, for a special moment.
We'll be sitting down with the authors of two new books, documenting and reflecting on the end of the analogue era of photography.
A photo used to be a thing, and now it's a stream of information. And that is no more powerfully true than with Polaroid photography, because obviously everyone is unique. If you have a physical Polaroid picture and you lock it in your desk drawer, it's yours. And so it's more like a painting in some ways.
And we'll talk with Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, about how to choose who to send where for our magazine.
We shoot everywhere in the world, but sometimes it's nice to commission someone to travel there and then do a story as well, and then they have like a fresh view on the place.
Plus we visit some current photo shows, Light from the Middle East at the V&A, Gina Soden at the Grout Show in London, and we drop in to celebrate 60 years of the Aperture Foundation. That shutter-speeding light and monitoring megamix is all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First of all, no prizes for guessing. We'll warm your ears with a little music. This is new from Toronto. The band are called Snowblink. The album is called Inner Classics, and the song is called Pray for Surf. That was Pray to Surf, new from Snowblink from Toronto, and we'll be hearing a little bit more from that album later in the show. Last week, it was Paris Photo, the art fair dedicated to photography, housed in the spectacular setting of that city's Grand Palais, and made extra international and perhaps more relevant than ever by a global spread of 128 galleries and, importantly, 23 publishers. This was Paris Photo's 16th edition, but the fair's really come into its own as an almost must-attend, thanks to its sumptuous staging and its ability to present a survey of world photography now. First of all, I had a coffee with Paris Photo director Julian Friedman, who seemed very happy with life on the first afternoon of the fair.
You have the feeling that you're not at a fair. You have the feeling that you are treated, you know, for a special moment. And I think that as we are the only photo fair in the world, and I include photo in a very large and broad sense, as you can see by the type of galleries and body of work being presented, I think it's a new experience for everybody that is coming. It's like, you know, you understand the role of photography in contemporary art in general, how all artists, major artists, relate to images today. And you can understand that from looking at historical material or more contemporary work. And that's what makes that fair unique. And the environment, of course, gives a lot of status to any gallery participating. The fair has not only an international flavor, but it's really two-thirds of the galleries are international, a third are French galleries. So it means, you know, we have galleries from all over the world and collectors from all over the world. And that's why it's unique. You know, it's not about being representative of one country. Of course, when you're in France, number of galleries apply, you know, from France. But the committee, which is making the selection, look at what are the proposals and just trying to find the best one.
Fair enough. What's it like if you're a museum curator, though, and you travel a lot and you're presented with a million images every day, and you know that a commercial setting has its drawbacks? Roxana Markoch, MoMA's curator of photography, can tell us.
I think that a large group of collectors and gallerists and curators are always gathering for Paris Photo because it's the in a certain way, the most special and most significant art fair on photography, and I'm happy to know that in fact Paris Photo will become Paris Photo LA in April, which will open in the Paramount Studios as well. So this interest between still and moving pictures and the whole expansion of the photographic medium is at the core of what Paris Photo is and could become. It gives you just a very tiny fraction of what is happening in photography right now, and that's due to the fact that what is happening right now happens in so many other places, and even with Paris Photo and being an international fair and being the best of all the photographic fairs, it's still impossible, you know, to canvas the entire spectrum of what is going in South Africa and, you know, in Asia and so many other parts of the world that where we need to pay attention to former Eastern Europe and, you know, areas that have been not as visible in the past, and then now they are sort of coming out. Truly, it's only in a very constant and steady pace that you can not only follow but also deepen the knowledge that such a broad, you know, world has.
Anyone mention Los Angeles? Britt Salverson is the Los Angeles County Museum of Art's curator of photography, and she sees a wider picture in Paris.
This fair is really great for its international range, and these are certainly things I would not see in Los Angeles or even New York. There's a really great range also of vintage early 20th century material and some 19th, but all the way up to contemporary. So you do get to, year by year, see some trends emerge and things evolve. This fair is encouraging because there's a wide range of different scales. For a while, all of the prints were big, big color prints at the art fairs, and that's very spectacular and seductive, but it's not always the easiest thing to acquire and display, and, you know, it's only one part of the photographic medium. Here I'm seeing more variety with smaller scale, vintage, black and white, and a whole range. Seeing the prints as physical objects is very satisfying, and not only in their frames, but most of the galleries bring things in boxes too, so you really get to kind of shuffle the deck and really remember that photographs are pretty amazing in their kind of texture and tactility and intimacy often.
All right, what about those galleries rocking up with photographs under their arms, hoping to make sales? Guillaume Lointier from Paris-based Suzanne Tarasiev Gallery reckons Paris Photo isn't just preaching to the choir, but it's a great place to meet new collectors.
We have a lot of collectors in Paris and France, and it's the opportunity to meet some new people from the other countries. So it's really important here. It's an international place, and Paris is good for that. And here, Paris Photo is well specialized in a medium. But we have the opportunity, because we are not fixed on the medium, but it's the opportunity to enlarge to another way to practice photo, like Boris or Delphine or Robert and Shanna. So it's,
The images. It might be radio, but we won't forget those. I met two galleries showing quite different works. Darius Himes from the Frenkel Gallery in San Francisco told me you needed a couple of big pieces to draw people into the booth. One of which was a striking black and white thing that hinted at the calligraphic by British artist Idris Khan.
The piece that we have is from a brand new body of work that was inspired by Cy Twombly's blackboard paintings. And what Idris is doing is making marks on a chalkboard in his studio and photographing both the marks as well as the erasures, and then building that up into a composite photograph. So this particular piece, which is called Over and Over, is comprised of about 1,000 to 1,200 individual layers of photographs that are then turned into a single piece. It's very abstract. The marks hover on the edge of legibility. I mean, you can't really... It looks like writing, but it's there's nothing to read.
Finally, I spoke to Nick Hackworth, director of London's Paradise Row Gallery, who took a different tack by presenting a curated show of two collaborative photographers, Adam Broomberg and Oliver Channerin. To photograph a dark horse in low light was the title, and as we hear, that strange phrase had an unpoetic reason for being. Nick Hackworth explains.
So the first image we're looking at is it's an image I'm actually not produced by Brunberg and Channer, and it's produced by Kodak. And it's the image of a lady. She looks, you can tell that she's in the 1950s. She's kind of got distinctively 50s haircut. She's got a fur stole around her shoulders, and she's got some high contrast kind of bits of cloth behind her. And it's a color correction card. And this is a narrative starting point for the show. And it's a color correction card that Kodak would have sent to color processing labs across America so they could determine whether they're printing the color of white skin accurately or not. So effectively, this is the gold standard for white skin in the 1950s.
She's a prom queen with a purpose.
Yes, she is, yeah. And what she represents, for Adam Lally, what's fascinating is that color film, up until the 1980s, was not capable of accurately capturing black and white skin tones simultaneously in the same image. There was an inherent bias in the color film towards white skin. So as you had, segregation started falling apart and evaporating, and you had particularly black and white kids in the same graduation shoots, becomes obvious. And the title of the show, To Photograph the Details of a Dark Horse in Low Light, is the very strange euphemistic phrase used by the head of research at Kodak to describe the capabilities of their film in the 1980s that could actually photograph black and white skin at the same time.
So, sales were made, and the fair took another boost to its reputation this year. But the curatorial firmament and gallerists determined to put on a show with a story rather than a supermarket sweep of shots made the deepest imprint in my personal darkroom. Los Angeles beckons in April for this fair with a fair wind of goodwill in its sails. Moving pictures, of course. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're exploring the world of photography. Time now to switch on the light box and inspect a couple of London exhibitions which have caught our eye. A little later on, we'll hear about Gina Soden's striking images of abandoned buildings. But first, we're off to the V&A, where a photography exhibition has just opened celebrating new work from the Middle East. It's the first major museum show that explores contemporary photos about or from the region and covers work from the late 1970s and the Iranian Revolution to the present day and the Arab Spring. I sat down with the exhibitor's curator, the V&A's head of photography, Marta Weiss, to hear more about how you capture the complexities and nuances of this vast area in one space.
The exhibition came about through a collaboration between the V&A and the British Museum. In 2009, the two museums were given a grant from the Art Fund to form a new joint collection of contemporary Middle Eastern photography. So in some ways, as far as curating the exhibition went, which I started working on in 2010, in some ways I was kind of working on an exhibition backwards because I actually had a pool of works to
contemporary stuff
to be including in the exhibition. And my job then was to sort of make sense of it and try and figure out how to create a narrative and form some arguments out of that work. And so in the end, the exhibition includes most of that joint collection. And also, once I had gotten further with planning the exhibition, I actually went back to the Art Fund and said, could we please have a little bit more money to make a few more acquisitions, which was really crucial. It filled in a few gaps and helped bring the entire exhibition together. In addition, there are also a few works in the exhibition that just already happened to be in the collections of either the British Museum or the V&A, but weren't part of this particular joint initiative. The main focus of the exhibition is contemporary practice, and so almost everything in the exhibition is from the past 10 to 15 years. The Abbas photographs are a little bit of an exception. They were acquired as part of that joint collection, and obviously they're such strong and iconic works. I put them right at the beginning to form a sort of prelude to the rest of the exhibition. And in some ways, the very last work in the exhibition, which does deal with the Arab Spring, which is Nermeen Hammam's photographs of soldiers in Tahrir Square from 2011, is also in a way kind of exceptional to the exhibition. So although it starts and ends with the earliest work and the most recent work, both of which deal in very, very different ways with different revolutions, in between, it's actually all kind of mixed up chronologically and spans more or less the past decade.
And in terms of themes of the exhibition, rather like our education secretary, you're very interested in three R's. They're not reading, writing, and arithmetic, but they are. You've got to tell me what they are because I wrote them down on another piece of paper.
Recording. Reframing. And resisting.
How do these three themes bear themselves out in the show? Because it's three separate rooms, essentially, isn't it?
That's right. So, yeah, there are three sections to the exhibition. And each of those terms, recording, reframing, resisting, refers to how the medium of photography is being approached by the artists who are gathered in that particular section. Obviously, all of those terms have other connotations as well, especially resisting. But really, it's about how photography is being used. If there's one unifying thread, I think that goes throughout the exhibition, it's a real self-awareness of photography and all its different applications, whether ranging from news photography to postcards. There's an awareness of the kind of vulnerability of the photograph as an object. So we have, for instance, Nyusha Tavakolian's photographs of called Mothers of Martyrs, of elderly Iranian women holding photographs, framed photographs of their sons who died in the Iran-Iraq War. So we see the photographs.
We were talking about these, weren't we, before we switched the microphones on, the beautiful colours in there, the amazing subject matter, very sort of sensitive and sympathetically shot portraits, but also with these beautiful, vibrant colours.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there is a lot of beauty in the exhibition.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as a lot of poignancy.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about that because I feel... We don't want to give the impression that this is a show about Middle Eastern photography has to be a worthy thing. There's a lot of very obvious beauty in it. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that was a counterpoint to some of the more serious themes in the show, or it simply goes part and parcel with the way that some of this stuff is rendered?
I don't think I necessarily see it as a contrast. I think it just goes along with it. In addition to beauty, I think there's also a lot of playfulness. There's irony. Yeah. There's a bit of humor. So it's certainly not all kind of depressing black and white photographs of unhappy situations.
And one of the things, other than some of the beauty and kind of popping colours that are in the show, there is very much also, I think, the idea of veracity and reliability of photography as a medium as well. One of the things that struck me was the video piece in the show. It's the only video piece in the show by Janani Al-Ani, who I think is an Iraqi artist.
An Iraqi British artist.
It's a big video screen, and these are shots that seem to be coming down almost from a satellite, zooming down onto the desert to show that the desert is not unpopulated. But it's almost... I don't know, without wanting to be too newsy about it, it feels like this might be the view from a spy satellite or a drone or something. It could be, or it could just simply be someone scrolling down from Google Maps.
She commissioned an aerial photographer to take these photographs over the desert in Jordan. And we see all different types of sites. And as you say, it's left completely open-ended, completely unexplained what sorts of sites we're actually looking at. Some of them are agricultural, some of them are archaeological sites, some of them are military, some of them are just homes, contemporary buildings. And the piece is very open-ended, but it makes reference to a lot of different ideas. One of them is just to simply demonstrate that the desert has been presumed in over centuries is not, in fact, unoccupied, but it is inhabited in all these different ways. And the camera does sort of zoom in a little bit, bringing to mind perhaps a dropping bomb getting closer and closer. But you also see these very abstract, quite beautiful images that really the scale is actually quite unexplained. In my essay in the catalog, I actually compare it to a photograph by Man Ray called Dust Breeding, where he photographed dust that had gathered on a sculpture by Marcel Duchamp, where the sense of scale is completely disorienting in a similar way.
And that was Marta Weiss, curator of Light from the Middle East, New Photography. And that show is on at London's Victoria and Albert Museum until 7th of April next year. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We'll be visiting another photography show next. This time, we're off to the Groucho. Chin chin.
The power of photography was pulled into focus at this year's Pre-Pic Day, the world's leading prize for photography in the realm of sustainability.
These are true artists, and they have incredible integrity. I mean, they tell you how it is. In the process, it's often disturbing. Sometimes it's beautiful in an abstract way, but it really touches a nerve.
Monocle Films attended the awards, and you can watch our film in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're framing and developing the theme of photography. The Groucho Club in London's Soho is a mecca for the cultural elite, drawing many of its members from the media, entertainment and arts. Famed for its illustrious clientele, it boasts a private art collection to rival many a contemporary gallery. Under the direction of curator and artist Nikki Carter, the venue recently hosted a short but sweet exhibition of photography by Gina Soden, featuring striking images of abandoned buildings from across Europe. Monocle's Jack Phillips met up with artist Gina Soden and curators Nikki and Rob Carter to find out more.
It's the day after the night before, sitting in a cosy wood panel lined enclave. It's a world away from the noise of the world outside. Perched on battered leather chairs, curators Nikki and Rob Carter run me through the heritage of the members-only venue.
The Groucho Club was started in 1985, and it's a private members club for people involved in film, TV, music, art, media generally. My position here is I'm curator of the art collection at the Groucho and have been so for 23 years.
I've known Nikki since we were 16, actually, but I was lucky enough to be given my first exhibition, my first photographic exhibition by Nikki here in the Groucho Club about 17 years ago. One of the rooms downstairs that is now the Soho Bar was an exhibition space. And Nikki curated almost monthly shows and very kindly gave me one before we got married and ended up working together, which is what we do now.
Nikki and Rob are artists in their own right, actively practicing their own crafts in their studio in London. This passion is echoed on every wall of this venue. Famed as a meeting point for artists, writers, and savvy graphic designers, its cult standing is as much due to the stories of the people as the artwork it houses.
It started probably in 1989-90 when I had left Goldsmiths College in South London with people like Damien Hirst and Angus Fairhurst and Rachel Howard and Colin Glenn and various artists. And the management at that time asked me if I'd like to put some artwork up. And so I got friends like those people, Mark Quinn and Damien Hirst, to actually put some artwork up at the beginning of their career. And obviously now they're very celebrated. I think a lot of amazing things have happened from the Groucho Club, or people sowing the seeds of various ideas. It's a hotbed of cultural thinking. It is where Damien Hirst met his manager, Frank Dumphy. It's where many kind of major Hollywood stars and A-listers have come with their film directors and so on.
We first came across Gina's work via Kate Bryant at the Fine Arts Society on Bond Street. We were just blown away by the quality and the imagery. Nikki and I work in a photographic practice which is very analogue based. We have a very old Cibachrome machine, we work on film, but this is a new and exciting way of using digital capture techniques to extraordinary lengths and details, and the quality is, it's almost quite painterly in some of the images, and we just felt it was no good just seeing it kind of online, and it had to be out there exhibited, and this was seemed like a very, very good place to start.
Gina Soden's show in a gallery space on the second floor looks as though it was made for the place, lining the walls with crisp and brutal imagery. As a series of 11 photographs, the work explores the romanticism intrinsic in the abandoned and decayed urban landscape.
The actual overview of the images are dereliction, so decay. So the actual title of the show is Retrogression, so it means bringing something back to a previous state, typically a worse one. A lot of these buildings I've been into, they've been abandoned for 20, 30 years. There's one called the Royal Stock Exchange, and it was the first building of its type in the whole world. And there's other buildings such as power stations, hospitals, manor houses, asylums, minor collieries. It's just an incredible array. And I've been to cities all over Belgium, Germany, most recently France and Luxembourg, and also the Netherlands. So that was part of a big trip this summer. And this is where the main body of work comes from in this show.
These photographs are effectively narratives. Although absent of any figures, the remnants of life are seen everywhere in the work. A dusty Christmas card on a mantelpiece. Food is left half-eaten in a manner that suggests an entire family was evacuated during a meal. A dance floor, complete with disco ball, haunts the glamour of an era past.
Immediately, you're drawn into the beauty of these quite often very ornate buildings, like the one just in front of us here. and you wonder about the history of the building, and you're fascinated about Gina's access to the building, and because that's a whole other story, a whole other level. For us, it was just the immediate visual quality of these very strong, striking images, beautifully shot and technically faultless.
Given a sense of place in the title, but your mind can't stop wandering. There aren't any actual people in the buildings, but there's evidence of human presence, and you're very drawn to that, I think.
With access to these dilapidated cultural landmarks being somewhat hard to get officially, Gina's pursuit of the perfect shot has seen her wiggle her way through gaps all over the world and even ravaged by dogs.
I was in an asylum in the UK, and I was in there for about 5 hours, and I'd had plenty of time to photograph it. I just packed my bags up and I heard a dog barking, and I think the security guard had no idea what was going on, but the dog was going nuts. He was sort of making the dog get closer and closer to me. I explained to him, I went in through this open door, which he propped a bit of wood against. He called the police. I had to get my memory card out of my camera as quickly as possible. I just stuffed it in my pants. By the time they'd come, I had a really bad headache, and the security guard had offered me a paracetamol. I'd had a cup of tea. I was stroking the dog Bella, and the police just said, don't come back. Sometimes I think, why do I do this?
So Gina was not torn to shreds, and we should be thankful for that, for she is part of a new wave of artists making a dent in the market in a climate where the debate between economic stability and success in the gallery is on everybody's lips.
The climate now, I think people are really interested in buying contemporary art.
Strikingly beautiful work, which these undoubtedly are, will always sell, no matter what the climate. People, good work sells, there's no doubt about it, as we saw last night.
It seems apt that works which deal primarily in what has been should be within a place with so much cultural history. The Groucho, with all its character, speaks of stories told and history being shaped. It's the perfect bosom for Gina's work. For Monocle, in London, I'm Jack Phillips.
And you're tuned in to Culture on Monocle 24. This has come in part two. We've looked at photography in the present, but what about the past? As digital continues to dominate, we'll meet two authors reflecting on the age of the analogue. I also get snapped up by Monocle's very own photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, as she explains how you commission work for a magazine, and we'll celebrate 60 years of the Aperture Foundation in New York. Say cheese. Time for another song from our album of the week. It's Inner Classics from Toronto's Snowblink, and this track is called Unsurfed Waves. That was Snowblink with Unsurf Waves from their new album Inner Classics, and you are listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We've already explored some photography from the present, so time now to take a trip to the past. At the height of its popularity in the 1970s, 1 billion Polaroid photos were shot each year. Likewise, the old film and photographic paper factories, which belonged to the likes of Ilford, Kodak and Polaroid, employed hundreds of thousands of workers combined. The sudden decline and closure of these spaces is the price paid for the digital photography revolution. And two books have just been published, both swan songs to the age of analogue, reflecting on the end of an era. The Disappearance of Darkness is a collection of photos documenting the closure and abandonment of many of these previously hidden factory spaces around the world. Our other book, Instant, details the world of Polaroid, from its invention to its dizzying popularity in the 1960s art world to its dramatic collapse in the noughties. Culture producer Katie Bilbao caught up with the book's authors, both photographers, Robert Burley and Christopher Bonanos, to hear about why they thought now was the time to capture the end of analogue.
I've been working on this actually for about 7 years now. And during that time, my medium has been utterly transformed. And the reason for that, of course, is digital technologies, which I also use and have embraced. But it's been a remarkable time to look backwards at what was photography as I'd known it throughout my lifetime. I mean, film-based photography used to be a medium that was used by everyone. It was an industry that employed hundreds of thousands of workers. And it was an art form that really defined the 20th century. So to see this disappear, to see, you know, all the tools and materials that I've used my whole life kind of fade into history has just been a very remarkable phenomenon to watch. And, you know, during that time, I've tried to record it. And of course, I've used film to do that with.
And Christopher, you've specifically looked at Polaroid and the history of Polaroid. What drew you to that specifically as a topic? And why do you think now is the right time to be looking back over its history?
Well, in terms of timing, it's much the same story Robert was telling, that Polaroid stopped making film in 2009. And so its analog era, which was almost 60 years old, effectively drew to a close. That meant that the story had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then it got an extra little coda in a company called The Impossible Project that has attempted to restart production of Polaroid film. So when you're a writer, you see a story arc like that and you say, that might be promising. Plus, I was always interested in the places where fine art and high technology meet. And Polaroid turns out to have been an amazing pioneer in that world. You know, Edwin Land, who founded it, explicitly said that he started his company at the place where the fine arts meet high tech. And not only he, but Steve Jobs actually said the same thing and credited Edwin Land with the idea.
I just want to bring Robert back in here, because one of the themes that kind of comes out in your book is this idea that this was a history of photography that took a huge amount of time and decades to build up. And then suddenly, in a matter of years, almost has just gone. Is that something that you were keen to kind of capture?
Well, I think for the most part, I was really just trying to understand it. And I think over that time period, photography has moved from being a purely physical medium, something that's created with celluloid, with paper, using processes that involve light and chemistry. It's moved from this physical medium into one that has been dematerialized by the digital world. And increasingly, we now experience photographs on screen.
Yeah, because one of the things that I think is interesting about photography is it's one of those things that is much about documenting history and it's as anything else, and it's been such an important part of our lives. And the physicality, I think, is really interesting, because when you think about Polaroid, we think about this hugely physical object. Can you tell us a bit more about kind of some of the stories from Polaroid that have emerged from your research?
It's a similar point I make at great length in the book, that a photo used to be a thing and now it's a stream of information. And that is no more powerfully true than with Polaroid photography, because obviously everyone is unique. Unless you're shooting with one of their specialty films that included a negative, it's not so easy to copy. If you have a physical Polaroid picture and you lock it in your desk drawer, it's yours. It can't escape onto the internet. It can't, you know, unless you scan it, it's a unique physical object. It is, as a friend of mine once said, an edition of one. And so it's more like a painting in some ways. And that, I think, makes people respond to it differently, because it feels a little bit precious. Especially because it's little, too. You can put it in your pocket, you know.
And I just want to bring Robert back in here, because as Christopher was saying there, there's something about having a physical picture which makes a difference to you kind of emotionally and mentally. And when we think about these physical pictures, this analog era, it's not just the actual pictures that were kind of tangible. There's huge kind of infrastructure to support that. So these factories that would make the films, processing plants where pictures would be developed, all those kind of places. Can you tell us a bit about the kind of spaces you were trying to document in your book?
The work that I did over the last 7 years really focuses on the photographic industry. So these are the companies like Polaroid, Kodak, and all of these companies have very long histories. They've been around for a very long time, in many cases well over a century. Companies like Kodak, of course, have had a very big brand name in every household around the world. And the really interesting thing for me was that they were constructed to manufacture products in absolute darkness, because that has been the defining feature of photographic materials since they were first invented in the 19th century, is that they are products that are created and used in the dark. And of course, as a photographer, I've spent a lot of time in darkrooms making photographs. So that was the element that I really wanted to capture, and I was able to go into these enormous spaces. In the case of Kodak, for example, we're talking factories that are the size of steel mills. They're just huge. And at one time, they ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, producing photographic films and papers so the world could make pictures. And over the last 7 years, each of these companies has gone into a kind of economic freefall because suddenly no one really needed their products in the same way. And most of the kind of mass markets that had been their customers moved to digital.
What is the kind of future for photography, and how do you think photographers will develop in the coming years ahead?
We don't know for sure, but I think certainly one of the things I'm seeing is that physical photographs are becoming objects that we experience increasingly in the art museum. As visual information, we tend to see photographs on the web more and more, even as documents of our personal and collective visual histories. We tend to see photographs as streams of information, as Christopher said.
That was Christopher Bonanos and Robert Burley, whose books, Instant, The Story of Polaroid and The Disappearance of Darkness, Photography in an Analog Era, are out now. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We'll be talking about reportage next. Stay tuned.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're snapping our way through a photography theme this week. We'll be getting our glad rags on to visit the Aperture Foundation's 60th birthday next, but first, time to explore the art of reportage, and more specifically, how you commission it. Enter stage left, Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto. See, that's exactly what we wanted, Pops, didn't we? We wanted you to do a sound effect. You've just taken a Polaroid.
Yeah, that's going to come out. Fuji camera thing.
That's a Fuji
It'll
camera.
It'll come out in half minute.
Do you have to shake it? Shake it like a Polaroid picture?
No, that's the thing. Everyone shakes it and then rub it under your arm and stuff. Don't do it. Just leave it like that.
So we're going to talk about how you commission stuff for Monocle. It's a magazine that obviously since day one, and it's now famous, now iconic, Japanese pilot on the front cover. Obviously, photos have obviously been a very central part of it, more so perhaps than other magazines, because we commission most of our stuff originally, don't we? We don't really buy cool-in stuff.
Yeah, almost 95%, even more sometimes, is all commissioned work. So we match a photographer with a story or, you know, where they are as well. So it's not just about if they are a good photographer or if we like them as well, but also where they're based. And sometimes, you know, we shoot everywhere in the world, but sometimes it's nice to commission someone to travel there and then do a story as well. And then they have like a fresh view on the place, you know, like always Moscow photographer shooting in Russia wouldn't be the same as someone coming from London who's never been to Russia doing it. So sometimes we mix it up. But
so you're trying to look almost with as have your photographer have as fresh eyes as the reader of the magazine does to find the foreignness and the interest in stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So quirkiness and things comes from that, I think. Yeah.
We'll talk about that then, because I've just come back. I was in Siberia a couple of weeks ago with Max Scher, who's a Moscow-based photographer, who's in St. Petersburg, then he was in Moscow. Krasnoyarsk, where I was based, this is going to be a story in Alpino. We thought Krasnoyarsk was going to be this huge, it's this kind of quite Soviet-looking city, and it's obviously surrounded by the no more big landscape than that of Siberia. How do you choose a photographer for that? Because it's clearly not about jump on a plane from Moscow and photograph it, is it?
So basically, some photographer, I think it's suited for sort of adventure shoots, sort of go and find out. You know, sometimes the brief isn't like shoot this and shoot that and shoot this, you know. It's more that, you know, you have to be sort of, same as a writer, you have to be sort of a reporter as well. And then think of, you know, everything you see, how is that going to put together as a visual story? So someone who can think of a story by himself, I think that's the most important thing for something, the story you've done, is it needs to be epic, it needs to be storytelling, you know, because I think people would read headline, people would look at pictures and then decide whether they want to read or not, you know. So if picture's not good, no one's going to read your copy, Rob.
The harsh realities of working at Magazine Pop. thanks to you for telling everyone how it works. But that's an interesting thing. I mean, how does it work? The difference between, I've done stories before which have been all about an office block. I remember the story I did at Der Spiegel, for example, where we wanted to explore this one building. So there are lots of, it was all interior shots, and it was all much more of an intimate portrait-based thing rather than a big epic thing, as you say. How do you choose the difference between those two photographers? Is it what's in their portfolio, or is it the feel for the story that you get off speaking to them on the phone, maybe?
I think sometimes it's obviously about what they've got in their portfolio, but I think that limits us as well as a picture editor. So like if we try to find something exactly the same and then trying to commission a photographer to do exactly the same for Monaco as well, it's sort of very limiting. And then some photographers get categorized and then they just do sports or they just do, you know, start to
You get typecast
shoot.
To do something that's only interior, only...
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's quite difficult because if you see something really greatly shot in a similar line of story, it's really easy to say, oh, that guy can do it. But it's nicer to think of how he sort of approached a story. So even if he was always shooting in Iceland or, you know, like sort of shooting wildlife, the way he shoots and the way he see things, I think is the most important things to catch in photographers.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you about fashion photography as well. Mm. This is something that Monocle's fashion photography has always been... I describe it, and you can maybe correct me here, but I've always described it as kind of like a usable idea of fashion photography.
Yes.
It's not the crazy heights of Italian Vogue or something where you can't quite work out which way up they're standing, let alone whether they're wearing a skirt or a pair of trousers or what the hell, right? Oh, that's a nice another sound effect
I
from
think
your,
that's the end for
your camera. So that picture of me is coming out. But anyway, fashion photography, how does that work?
I mean, Rich had from the beginning, he wanted to do something.
Who's our creative director.
Creative director. He wanted to do something quite realistic and believable. People want to see the fashion. So it's really important we see the clothes and how it's worn. But apart from that, we're trying to be, real, because everything else in the Monaco is sort of all reportage, portrait of real people is, we don't send hand makeup to do prime minister's portrait, so that everything's quite realistic. So even fashion needs to sort of have that feel so that everything in a Monaco seems to be curated, without thinking hard.
Without being too stylized.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that we try.
Thanks, Poppy. Say cheese.
Cheese.
And that was our very own photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, getting snap happy with me here in Studio One for this here culture show with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And to finish the show and round off our theme, we're off to New York for a look into an organisation that's long been at the core of the photography world. The Aperture Foundation, one of the world's premier photography publishers, has just marked its 60-year anniversary, and the group has much success to celebrate. Founded in 1952 by a group of photographers, including Ansel Adams, Dorothea Lange and Minor White, it set about creating a forum for fine art photography at a time when it was still largely focused on documentary. For a look into the world of Aperture 60 years on and a glimpse of how photography's changed over the years, Monocle's Barrett Austin caught up with its publisher, Leslie Martin.
Aperture does many things. I mean, we started out as a publisher of a magazine, and from there we grew into publishing books. We have an exhibition space and a long history of an exhibition program. We also feature artist prints. We have a growing education program. Everything that we do is dedicated to promoting photography and to providing the best possible platform for photographers' projects.
And just to look back at Aperture's history, if we could go back to when Aperture was founded in 1952, tell us what the charge of the group was when it was founded, who some of the founders were, and how the focus has changed over 60 years.
It was founded by a group of photographers, in particular Minor White, who became the editor and served as editor through 1976. He was very interested in, and all of them were, but he became sort of the proponent who carried Aperture forward. They felt like there wasn't a vehicle for talking about photography, for finding common interests, for reaching out, for sharing what they were working on, for talking about, for arguing about. I mean, the early pages of the magazine, you can sort of see the shape of modern photography, and in particular modern fine art photography, as they called it, really coming into focus.
And to consider this quite large book, the anthology that Aperture has just put out, examining the first 25 years of what was done within this organization, what are some of the great accomplishments that are profiled here?
Well, I mean, again, I think what was great about Aperture at that time is it was this forum for the identity of photography as a fine art to get hashed out. And there are people, you know, from the earliest time saying photography is an elastic form. It can encompass documentary. It can encompass, you know, the most abstract of images. There are really no boundaries except for our imagination. And, you know, people argued about those things. So I think its greatest contribution, one, was to provide this sort of vehicle for people to talk about these concepts. It also was one of the first places, and for a long time, one of the only places to get an extensive portfolio of photographs published. I mean, you could see, you know, early Robert Frank, you know, people like Harry Callahan, even John Sarkowski published and wrote in the pages of Aperture magazine. I mean, it really was the place that you had to be published and seen for, you know, many, many decades, and hopefully still continues as such.
Aperture's founders considered it a common ground for the advancement of photography. What do you make of the state of photography in 2012?
It's very, very exciting. And I really do find this sort of kindred spirit of exploration and wanting to stretch to find the boundaries of what's possible with photography. I mean, we don't think of the early pages of Aperture as so experimental because, you know, we've gotten used to seeing small black and white photography. But today, I think there is an equal spirit of, well, what is this thing that we call photography? Does it matter if you take it with your cell phone? Does it matter if you are actually creating it in a computer? Or do you have to really ascribe to sort of the 8x10 pure film photography? And in fact, Aperture embraces and encourages all of those forms. I mean, so long as it's really authentic, original, and has something to say, we want to find a way to help photographers say it.
What are you looking forward to in Aperture's seventh decade?
Aperture's next decade really is going to continue to be one of innovation, and we are going to keep trying to respond to the needs of the photographers that we work with, which will include working more in the digital field, both, again, dissemination. We're building our own multimedia arms internally with our new website, with more video content. I mean, photography has so many definitions now. We need to continue to find as elastic as forms as possible. So I look forward to just keep trying new things and working with new photographers, working with the photographers we've worked with in the past who are trying new things, but to keep moving forward.
And that was Leslie Martin, publisher for the Aperture Foundation, talking to Monocle's Barrett Austin in New York City. And that's just about all we have time for in this week's show. Next week, we'll be exploring some cutting-edge advertising, among other things. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. My producer was Katie Bulbert, ably assisted by the editing wizard, Holly Fisher. Electronic mail, we're into it. rb@monocle.com or kb@monocle.com. Let us know what you'd like to hear. Time for one final song this week from Snowblink. This is Black and White Mountains. Thanks for tuning in. Oh, geodes for life.